Just to everyone out this morning. Hope you had a great week. We'll continue on with our study of what I call the Bible you probably haven't read yet. It's looking at things that we don't always look at with a good hard eye to it to learn something from. And that's the archetypes in the Old Testament and how God changed them in the New Testament. Now this is not anything that's not in the Bible, it's there, it's just often overlooked. It's kind of like this guy who went to a small southern town, it was around Christmas time, and there he saw a nativity scene, and it showed the great skill and talent of the people who lived around there. But one small feature of the nativity scene bothered him greatly. The three wise men were all wearing farmer's hats. Totally unable to come up with a reason of why that would be, he left and he stopped at a little country store not too far away, and you know, to get himself something, a Coke or something to drink. And he asked the lady behind the counter about the, you know, why the wise men were wearing farmer's helmets. And she got mad at him and yelled at him. He says, "You people come over here into this town and you just don't know your Bible," she says. I assured her that, you know, I'm a church-going man and that I did, but simply couldn't recall anything about farming in the Bible. Well, she grabbed her Bible from behind the counter and she ruffled through some pages real quick, and she finally jabbed her finger at a passage and shoved it up in her face, and she said, See? Right there it says the three wise men came from afar. So, that's not exactly what the Bible tells us, but I assure you, the archetypes are in there. In Exodus 16:4, if you want to turn that there with me, we kind of dealt with chapter 16 of Exodus before, and we're going to go past the verses that we read. We dealt mainly with the first three verses of Exodus 16. But in verse 4, then the Lord says to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my instruction." That's interesting, right? You know, just on the level right there, and I will test them. God tests us every day to see if we'll continue to follow Him. And it may not make any sense. It may seem like we're trudging along and things aren't what they're supposed to be, but, you know, He is testing us in that way. In verse 5 now, in Exodus 16, "On the sixth day, when they prepare what I bring in, it will be twice as much than they gather daily." Because, you know, of course, in the seventh day they rested, and that day He gave them a double portion. "Now the people grew tired of the manna, and they wanted meat. In Numbers 11, Moses even said to God, 'Why do you burden me with these people?'" And this is the best part I like. It's almost amusing. He went on to say that, you know, "I didn't give birth to them. You know, they're not my responsibility," Moses is saying. "Why do you saddle me with the responsibility? Why am I responsible for this?" So, in Numbers 11, God comes up with a solution. He's going to give them the meat they want, but not for a day, not for a week, or 20 days, but for a whole month. In Numbers 11:20, "But a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you and have wept before Him, saying, 'Why did we leave Egypt?'" Now that's an interesting thing. And this brings back a story. And I know Sharon's seen this drawing, but there was another student in school who was a pretty good artist. And I'll always remember it, you know, because he made this for everyone. He drew it out of a kind of a pencil, I guess. But here was these Israelites, and they had these little bird feet sticking out of their nostrils. And that was the image he saw for this verse. And they had a sour, dour look, whatever you want to call it, on their face. But just, you know, his interpretation of what this verse was here. And I just always found that funny. I wish I could have found it, because I know I have it someplace, to show you just how great it was for him to illustrate that. But that's what God was going to do, because they grumbled. Now Moses, you know, he's starts by asking God if they should gather up the animals for the meals, and his list is quite tasty when he starts naming them. However, God is not there to cook them a five-star meal, you know, a four-star meal, whatever they call it. But he's there to teach them a lesson. The winds gathered up quails from four corners of the earth, and they ate until they were sick. They ate and ate and ate. Whatever God provides for us, don't grumble about it. It could always be worse. You know, Miriam became leprous for several days because she complained to Moses. Complaining to God about what we have is like a slap in the face of God. It's kind of like a team. Let's say you scrimped and saved, and you're trying to buy them a new car for them to go to college, you know, after Christmas and all that, and you do it all, and you give all your heart into it, and you think they're going to be happy about it, and they get out there, and they say, well, I don't like it. I don't care for it at all. How would you think you would feel? Well, that's what God feels when we reject what he gives us. When we're not happy with what God puts in front of us, then we're not happy. And there are times that our situations are not situations that we would call situations of joy. But they could be situations of testing, of instructing, of bringing us closer to him. We can either do two things when the trials of life come upon us. We can either lean on God or run away from him. That's our choices. You know, and it's easy to complain. I think it's our most enjoyable pastime sometimes to complain about things. You know, at the beginning of the new year, a high school principal decided to post his teacher's New Year's resolutions on the bulletin board. He thought it would be good for everyone to see what other people were going to do for the next year, try to resolve. And as the teachers gathered around the bulletin board to see their resolutions for that year, one teacher just started complaining. She said, "Why weren't my resolutions posted?" she said. She was throwing such a temper tantrum that the principal hurried to his office to see if he had overlooked her resolutions. Sure enough, he had mislaid them on his desk, and they were underneath another pile or something. And as he read her resolution, he was astounded. Her first resolution was not to let little things upset her in the new year. So I think we do love to complain a little bit too much. Or there was two men who stopped before an owl, before a display window where an owl was on display. Well, the two men immediately began to criticize the way it was mounted. They said its eyes aren't natural. Its wings are not in proportion with its head. And then they said its feathers are not even neatly arranged, and its feet could have been improved. When they finished their criticism, the old owl turned his head around, looked at him, and gave him a wink. It's much easier to criticize than to be correct. And, you know, we're pretty good at criticizing. You know, there's a story called The Little Red Hen. It said, during the winter of 1940, Josephine Kunt's husband, a house painter and textile worker, was temporarily unemployed because of the weather and a seasonal layoff. It was a difficult time for the family. They literally had no money. Their 18-month-old daughter Rachel was recovering from pneumonia and wasn't doing well. The doctor insisted that Rachel eat a boiled egg each day, but even that was beyond their means during that time. "Why not pray for an egg?" suggested a young friend. They were a church-going family, but the idea of actually praying for their need was something they had never really considered. Josephine wasted no time. On her knees, she prayed that God would provide an egg each morning for her daughter. Later that morning, Josephine heard some cackling coming from the hedge fence in front of their home. Among the bare branches sat a fat red hen. She had never seen this hen before and had no idea where it had come from. She just watched in amazement as the hen laid an egg and then walked off. In a moment, the hen was gone, but there lay the egg in her yard. "What do you do with such circumstances?" she said, "but thank God." The next day, Josephine was startled once again to hear the cackling by the hedge. The red hen came every day for over a week, repeated the routine. Each day, little Rachel had a fresh boiled egg. The little girl got better. The weather improved. And Josephine's husband went back to work. The next morning, I waited by the window and watched, she said. But the little red hen did not return. Now, the cynical person might have said that the hen probably made a mistake and walked in front of a Kentucky Fried Chicken one day. But the person of faith knows what happened here. You ever notice sometimes that you'll come into some money for some reason or other, and then a little later you have to use the money to pay a bill or fix something? I know it happens to us all the time. We always wish, I hope I could have held on to that money. Instead, we should rejoice in the fact that God knew we would need it, and He provided it for us at that time. And don't criticize others and what they have. God has provided to each according to what He has. You know, God alone knows the heart of a person. You know, one of the most famous preachers of the 1800s, Charles Spurgeon. He was Queen Victoria's favorite preacher, even though he was a Baptist, and of course, the Queen of England was the Anglican. And Spurgeon and his wife had a practice of selling, but not giving away, the eggs their chickens laid. Even close relatives were told, if you want them, you have to pay for them. Since he had a huge church and a salary to match, some people labeled Spurgeon as greedy. They thought he had more than enough. Sort of how television evangelists are labeled today. The Spurgeons accepted the criticisms without defending themselves. They never offered up an answer as to why they charged for those eggs. It was only after that Mrs. Spurgeon had died that the whole story was revealed. All the profits from the sale of the eggs went to support two elderly widows that they knew. Never grumble over what someone else has. God has chosen for them to have that, and He has chosen you to have what you have. Rejoice in what He provides for us. God changed the manna that they had in the field from food in the wilderness that sustains the physical life to Jesus, the living bread that sustains for eternity. In John 6:51, I am the living bread that came down out of heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread also which I will give for the life of this world, of the world, is my flesh. You know, the Israelites call the food manna. You know what manna means? What is it? You're right, absolutely. Manna means what is it? They didn't know what it was, but they ate it. But here is Jesus, the true bread from heaven. And they don't know, a lot of people don't know what He is either. They didn't know then that it was miraculous stuff. Jesus compares Himself to the manna, except that He is greater. He is telling them that He is a miracle to them as well, because the manna fell from heaven. The manna in the wilderness gave temporary satisfaction and fulfillment. It serves as a foreshadow or archetype of the true bread from heaven, Jesus. In John 6:32, then Jesus said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, Moses gave you not the bread from heaven, but my Father giveth you the true bread from heaven. When we get before the Lord's Supper here, when we eat of that, and we eat of His body, this is my body which I give you to eat, this is my blood which I shed for you. These are the symbols of that archetype. These are the symbols that show that every breath we take, what we draw into our hearts and our minds and to our stomachs for nourishment comes from Christ. We do not live without God. We do not live without the Creator. The Creator created us. There's another verse that says, does the clay tell the potter what it's going to be or what it's going to do? The potter does that. Now, God created us, thankfully, out of love, and not to torture us or be cruel and mean like Satan would if he had created us, if he had that power. But that we were created out of love, for love, to be loved, and to love back. Paul tells us in Romans 9:20-21, but who indeed are you, a human being, to argue with God? What is molded say to the one who molds it? Why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out the same lump, one object for a special use and another for an ordinary use? Who are we to complain to God about how we're made, or the job He's given us to do, or that we don't have what someone else does. There's a cute children's story that comes from Australia, and it was a comic book originally in the early 1900s called Fatty Finn. And in the 80s, they made it into a, I guess, kind of like a Little Rascals kind of story out there. And there was an interesting character out there in the whole story. He's not any part of the main story. He's involved a little bit at some point. But he was the fellow who went around in a small town collecting and emptying the chamber pots each day from the people. Now, you would think that that's not a very nice job or not a very good job. But you know what? He went around, he whistled, and he was happy. He was probably the happiest man in that whole little Australian village or town or whatever, as he took care of such an unseemly task then. And that always made an impression on me. You know, we have people out there and they're jealous of others. They envy others. They want to be above others or that. Or they complain about, why did this happen to me? I was just as good as this person or that person. Or why did he or she have all the luck and all that? But you know what? God created us for a purpose. And some of the most ordinary purposes are some of the most important purposes. There's another show I kind of like to watch. It's Dirty Jobs. And this guy goes around and he finds the most filthiest and disgusting jobs that people out there do for a living. And he goes out and does it with him and learns about it. And it's amazing just what kind of jobs people have out there. And they choose to do it. You know, maybe some of them, they're not the smartest people in the world, but they're happy with what they're doing and they do it. And you know, it's great that they do it. If we didn't have the garbage man to come around and deal with, you know, what we don't like to deal with. If we didn't have the septic guy to come and do what he does. If we didn't have, you know, doctors and nurses that like to cut open and work with people and all that kind of stuff. I mean, a lot of us wouldn't be able to take that kind of stuff. God has purpose for everyone to take their place and do their part in this kingdom. And He has worked it out. You know, if we were all doctors, then, you know, who would bring the doctor his mail? Who would fix the doctor's car? Who would, you know, fix the doctor's house? You know, you get the picture. Everyone has to do something different in this life for everyone to get along. The Bible tells us that we're all made up in the body. We all take our part. And the feet are important, just as the hands are. And the eye is no more important than them. An eye can't get anywhere on its own. I seen a commercial a while back, and I think it was a Coke commercial or Pepsi or something like that, and they had these eyes, well, the eyes had little legs they had to get around, but, you know, they couldn't enjoy the soft drink because they weren't a tongue. And the tongue comes along and can enjoy the drink, but he can't find it without the eye and stuff like that. But anyway, we're all important in God's kingdom, and we all have a place, and we all have certain things that God has given us. And we need to rejoice in what God has given us. Because what we all have, what we have in common from the richest Christian to the lowliest Christian, is that right there. That Lord's Supper, that salvation from Christ, that love of God in Christ. The rich man has no more than the poor man, but they all have it. God provides for us. He gives us all that we need. Where we need it, just as He did for Israel during the Exodus. Looking back, what have you lacked? You may not have had meat every day or the tastiest bread, but haven't your needs been met? And He has met our greatest need, that being salvation. Once we realize how great that is, we'll never complain over what He provides for us in this life. Are you hungry? Spiritually hungry? Are you suffering hunger pains from sin or bad habits? Are you lacking a purpose in life or emptiness in your life? Would you be satisfied from the inside Do you want to be satisfied from this life? Then fill yourself with the bread from heaven, Jesus Christ, who came to save us. From sustenance in the wilderness till salvation. God changed that archetype so that we could be saved. I don't know what your needs are this morning, or if you have need at the church. If you do, won't you come as we stand and sing the song of invitation?